And it's just.
Are you planning to sue?
We plan to take some type of action. I don't know if we're going to sue yet or not, but.
But it's still in the air.
Can I throw in a comment?
Yes, Chris.
First of all, don't you miss Muhammad Ali? Don't you?
I'm missing.
But the Alis have become the focus. We're getting calls, as I said, from all forms of Muslim organizations, all forms of support groups. And I believe, although they didn't ask for this fight, they took on the wrong people. And I think they're going to become the focus and a rallying point for this struggle. Now, as far as a lawsuit, we're working on towards that. Obviously, we're trying to get everybody who is similarly profiled to contact us or to contact an organization that we can work with. And if anything, Muhammad fought for respect.
That's right.
And so is his wife and his son.
We have to carry on the legacy. We have to help others because other people who are immigrants that have a problem, they don't have a voice. And we have to stand there and be a voice for them.
Well, just to think about the Muslims, the citizens in the United States, they go make their Hajj like we have to do every once in a lifetime. You know, it's a practice that we do. And they go make their Hajj, and should they be worried about getting back into the country and to their families?
Well, it cannot be denied the Alis are fighters. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month we're celebrating Fat Tuesday on Tuesday, February 28th, with the Les Blank films Always for Pleasure and Dry Wood. Les Blank sat at the kitchens and on the porches of Creole folk in the Delta to capture their Mardi Gras spirit and traditions to make the film Dry Wood. Les filmed Always for Pleasure, documenting the 1970s carnival celebrations in New Orleans. Again, that's a night of films by Les Blank to celebrate Fat Tuesday, February 28th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The time is now 5:02 p.m. Up next is your evening news, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday, from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the death of Sarah McElvin marks the sixth killing of trans woman person of this year.
Another Jewish cemetery is vandalized.
And Betsy DeVos makes some uneducated statements.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 28th, 2017. I'm Jenny Okuyama.
And I'm Zelos Marchand. President Donald Trump is set to make what his team is billing as his biggest speech yet when he gives a joint address to Congress at 9 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. A source in the White House provided a list of the president's talking points, which include tax and regulatory reform, improvements to the workplace for working parents, healthcare reforms, education access, increased military spending, and commitments to veterans. A senior administration official says that Trump will open the speech with a call for unity before touting a push to complete the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines as his early accomplishments. According to the official, Trump will cite an infrastructure bill, space exploration, education, and curbing illegal immigration as legislative priorities, and talk about protecting the country from, quote, radical Islamic terrorism, end quote, and ISIS. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said Monday that the theme of the speech will be, quote, the renewal of the American spirit, unquote.
China Del Dupree, also known as China Gibson, was shot to death last Saturday night in New Orleans. China was a nationally known transgender artist famous for her timeless drag performances, her love of the ballroom community, and her loving personality. She was also known as the dancing diva of the South. She was living in California and had decided to return to New Orleans to visit family, friends, and to celebrate Mardi Gras. China was found near the 4300 block of Downman Road at about 8:30 p.m., where she died at the scene from multiple gunshot wounds. By 9:30 p.m., police had cordoned off the area. China is the fifth trans woman killed in 2017. Sarah McElvin, as of yesterday, is the sixth. Rest in power.
Cancers of the colon have been declining in older adults in recent decades and have always been considered rare in young people, but scientists are reporting a sharp rise in colorectal cancers in adults as young as their 20s and 30s. Rates have been increasing for every generation born since 1950. Experts aren't sure why. Most colorectal cancers are considered a disease of aging, so any increase in young adults, especially when rates of the disease are on the wane in older people, is both baffling and worrisome, experts say. Experts attribute lowering cancer rates to changes in risk factors, particularly lifestyle changes like smoking cessation and healthier diets. Diets that include more fruits, vegetables, and fiber and less red meat are linked to lower colorectal cancer risk. Obesity and sedentary lifestyles are also associated with colorectal cancer, as are heavy alcohol use and chronic conditions like inflammatory bowel disease and type 2 diabetes, all of which are on the rise. Many patients are so young at the time of diagnosis that they have not been screened for or by colonoscopy. Those with colorectal cancer may experience a warning signs, but the symptoms are typically vague, including digestive complaints like diarrhea, constipation, cramping, and abdominal pain.
Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos described historically black colleges and universities as, quote, real pioneers when it comes to school choice, end quote, on Monday evening after meeting with several presidents from those institutions. In response, critics accused her of ignoring the fact that most of the schools were founded because black students were not allowed to attend segregated white schools, not because founders wanted to give African Americans more options in higher education. Ms. DeVos, an aggressive backer of publicly funded vouchers, is scheduled to speak today at a luncheon for school presidents at the Library of Congress. Her critics are accusing her of using the nation's history of segregation to advance a contemporary political agenda. Senator Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri, called DeVos' comment, quote, totally nuts.
Lawmakers in Connecticut are considering a bill that would limit the use of solitary in the state's prisons. A replica of a solitary confinement cell is currently the state capital as part of a program called Inside the Box, which also includes film screenings, a dance performance, and panels of legal experts. Lawmakers and individuals who have survived solitary. Melinda Tuthus reports from New Haven.
Pollution okay, pot not. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
The Trump administration is set to start the work of dismantling climate and water rules as early as next week.
That's according to new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who spoke last week at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC.
Pruitt wants to give states more of a say in air and water protection to ensure that regulations are reined in.
An example of what he means is being played out in West Virginia, where a bill that would allow more pollution to be discharged into rivers and streams was approved by a legislative committee.
The bill would change the way pollutants are measured so that discharge permits would allow significantly more contaminants in water, according to a consultant who spoke with the Charleston Gazette-Mail.
The bill is being pushed by the State Manufacturers Association with the support of Governor Jim Justice. The governor said in his State of the State address that regulators should stop standing in the way of business growth.
He denigrated state environmental inspectors, saying they wear T-shirts, old jeans, and haven't shaved in forever.
According to Angie Rosser with the Western Virginia Rivers Coalition, it comes down to whether the legislature wants more toxic and cancer-causing chemicals in water or not.
While the feds want to allow states more leeway with pollution regulations, not so fast with marijuana.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said the administration expects federal officials to enforce drug laws prohibiting marijuana in states that now allow recreational use.
The feds will continue to allow medical pot, but the Trump spokesman said that he believes recreational use may encourage people to try opioids, basically the theory that weed is a gateway drug.
But the marijuana industry is already quite large, employing thousands. One state benefiting from legalization is accommodating the industry, particularly in its use of water, even as the administration gets mad over reefers.
A little more than a week ago, a court in Colorado approved an application to use water to grow pot for both medical and recreational use.
The company asking for the permission wants a water right to irrigate up to 3,000 pot plants.
The application was filed in the complex water courts in Colorado and was approved, even though pot is still a controlled substance, as the White House pointed out.
Aspen Journalism reports that there may not be an appeal of the decision granting the water right. It seems the main objections were not to the use of the water, but instead the amount required.
The Colorado court pointed out that while federal law may ban pot, it does not ban using water to grow marijuana.
Last Friday, Pope Francis said that access to clean drinking water is a basic human right.
His remarks came as he met with 90 international experts who participated in what was called a dialogue on water held at the Vatican.
The Catholic News Service reports that the Pope cited statistics from the UN that said each day 1,000 children die from water-related illnesses and millions of people consume polluted water daily.
The pontiff also said that he asks himself if we are all headed toward a world war over water.
The struggle to protect water from pollution has led to violence, as most know, in North Dakota, maybe not on the scale feared by the Pope, but still with people being attacked by dogs, water cannons, and bullets.
The day before the Pope made his remarks, police officers in North Dakota removed all remaining water protectors from the main Standing Rock camp.
Videos of the police action resemble military operations, with armed vehicles and riot-clad officers heavily weaponized.
At one time, the Standing Rock camp contained 10,000 people, but last week only 70 remained, according to Vice News. There's a new study about fracking and its potential threat to water, which shows it is more significant than thought.
This new report, done by researchers at Duke University, looked at spills not only during the fracking process itself, but long after drilling, as much as 10 years.
The study found that there had been nearly 7,000 releases or spills from fracked wells over a 10-year period in four states: North Dakota, Colorado, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania.
What was significant about this new research is that a prior study done by the EPA found only about 460 spills in a shorter period, but that EPA report did not look beyond just a few days after drilling.
The new work showed that about half of the spills occur around storage of liquids and moving them through pipelines.
Most of the spills studied occurred in North Dakota, where police just removed protesters from the Standing Rock site. And finally, we've all had bad hair days when we want to hide, but that uncooperative hairdo of yours, it could score you some cold hard cash. Operative word being cold.
People from all over the globe are heading to Canada to create the most artistic hairstyle possible by freezing it. The most dramatic coif could win $750.
To enter the contest, you first have to get yourself to Tikini Hot Pools in the Yukon and soak in their hot springs.
And it's got to be cold enough, somewhere in the neighborhood of -4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Don't worry, the pool is toasty, averaging about 108 degrees, and for that reason, it emits a lot of steam, which then freezes your hair.
The Tikini website gives step-by-step instructions for the best results, which include the caveat that it could take a while. Two of the steps in the process are wait and then wait some more.
Eventually, your hair will be ready to sculpt to a design limited only by your imagination. Think Medusa or Einstein.
When you're ready, take a selfie and submit it to the contest. Winners will be announced mid-March.
Curious to see the hair-raising early submissions? Go to our website at h2oradio.org to see the frozen bobs, or as the Daily Telegraph called them, permafrosts. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Build a better world through better water at AWWA's ACE 17 in Philadelphia, June 11th through 14th. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE17.
Guided relaxation, low-key classical music, and gentle animal noises all have something, one thing in common, that's their ability to lower blood pressure, especially if someone is above the age of 55. A small study conducted by American Heart Association involved 41 people in retirement homes who were given 12 minutes of relaxing sounds three times a week for 4 months. Each person who listened to oceanic or calming animal sounds showed a 6.4 lower drop in blood pressure than listening to Mozart sonatas. Relaxing sounds have also been proven to de-stress, calm, and improve sleep patterns regardless of age.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for A Caravan of Glam at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area calls for showers with a high of 51 degrees and a low of 39. East of the Cascades, we'll see mostly cloudy conditions with a high of 50 degrees and a low of 31. Today in history, jazz legend Thelonious Monk was on the cover of Time magazine. Today's quote also comes from Thelonious Monk. Where's jazz going? I don't know. Maybe it's going to hell. You can't make anything go anywhere. It just happens.
It's 5:20. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Pollution okay, pot not. That and other stories on H2O.
I love the names. Bobcat Farm, Golden Eagle Ranch, Long Prairie, Pintail Vineyard, Roadrunner Ranch, and 10 Mile Farm. They conjure up Americana, the old home place, and our rich rural culture. Less bucolic, however, is the fact that all are part of a massive Wall Street investment scheme called Farmland Partners, Inc. It's run by a couple of slicks trained in mergers and acquisitions as executives at the investment powerhouse Merrill Lynch. Rather than sodbusters, Farmland Partners are taxbusters, using a legalistic plow called REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust, to get enormous tax breaks to subsidize their scheme. With this special subsidy, the partners have attracted hundreds of millions of dollars from investors to buy up farms and ranches. They now own 295 ag properties, covering 144,000 acres in 16 states. Of course, the Wall Street plowboys don't soil their own soft hands by actually farming. No, no. The syndicate hires tenant farmers to do the sweaty work of plowing, planting, and nurturing the crops. This tenant system produces a double-line cash flow for the faraway owners. Farmland Partners charges the tenants rent for tilling the corporate soil. Then the partners harvest a sweet share of any profits from the sale of crops the tenants produce. Meanwhile, the young farmers America desperately needs, those who actually want to, you know, farm, are having a hard time finding affordable land to get started. These new generation farmers can easily be outbid for good land by Wall Street speculators who have the cash flow from tenants and the subsidy from taxpayers to underwrite their financial contrivance. This is Jim Hightower saying, to prevent the money schemers from literally walling off young farmers and to fight this insidious Wall Street takeover of agriculture, connect with youngfarmers.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 25% of the Environmental Protection Agency's budget is being cut by Trump. Approximately 3,000 EPA jobs will be cut, going from 15,000 down to a staff of 12,000. John O'Grady is president of AFGE's National Council of EPA Locals, the largest union representing EPA workers.
Morale is in the basement, possibly lower. We're already at a point where we don't have enough staff to do everything that Congress has tasked us with. And to reduce the staff by another 3,000 is going to make it impossible for US EPA to protect human health and the environment. They're going to cut climate change activities. They're going to cut waters of the United States. If you like to fish, if you like to just enjoy nature, that may impact your ability to have those enjoyments.
O'Grady says federal enforcement capacity and standards are also endangered by these cuts. That would lead to different environmental standards and enforcement by the states, rather than having a uniform national standard for environmental protection.
It's too easy for a plant manager to say to the governor, hey, look, get these guys off my back. I bring 10,000 jobs to this state. Do you want me to leave? And so what's the governor going to do? Is he going to say, no, that EPA regulation is going to stay in place? No, he's going to loosen it.
Instead of trying to improve EPA's environmental protection mission, the Trump administration is attacking, dismantling, and suppressing it. O'Grady says the bullying at EPA includes attacking AFGE, the largest union representing EPA workers.
Going after our dues deductions, automatic payroll deductions. They're doing a number of other things that will inhibit us from continuing to represent. That's the kind of thing that sends a chilling effect throughout the agency so that people think, okay, you don't mess with these guys, I'll lose my job. I've got a family, I've got a house mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, people are keeping their heads down. There's no question we're under attack.
A coalition including the National Consumers League is launching a campaign urging consumers to close Wells Fargo bank accounts until forced arbitration requirements are dropped. Forced arbitration prevents consumers from taking Wells Fargo to court. The coalition says it's targeting Wells Fargo Bank over its illegal practices and to protect consumer rights to hold businesses accountable in court.
National Consumers League Executive Director Sally Greenberg says her organization pulled money from Wells Fargo and instead put it in the Bank of Labor. She says the Bank of Labor has a very fair agreement for depositors with no forced arbitration clause.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Former Labor Secretary Tom Perez has won the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee with a 235-200 vote over Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison. After winning on a second round of voting, Perez appointed Ellison as deputy chair, a new position, in a move to bring Ellison's supporters in coalition with the party as a whole. Ellison was strongly backed by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, as well as Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Perez received much of his support from members of more closely aligned with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. In his victory speech, Perez vowed to wage an all-out war to deny Donald Trump a second term. Ellison said in a joint news conference that he sees his job as a bridge for Democratic institutions as both urged party unity. Perez is the first Latin American to hold the post.
A Georgia judge sentenced Kayla Norton and Jose Torres to spend a combined 19 years in prison for their role in a racist rampage at an 8-year-old's birthday party. The assault occurred in July 2015, 1 month after a gunman killed 9 worshippers at a historically black church in Charleston, South Carolina. After the threatening black motorists, the gang of white supremacists that included Norton and Torres headed to the town of Douglasville, where they forced their way into an outdoor birthday party that included a cookout and bouncy castle. The gang members shouted racial slurs, made armed threats, and waved Confederate battle flags in violation of the Georgia Street Gang Terrorism and Prevention Act.
Philadelphia police are looking for vandals who damaged more than 100 gravestones at a local Jewish cemetery less than a week after a similar incident at a Jewish cemetery in St. Louis, less than a week after another one. This comes as bomb threats have forced evacuations of Jewish community centers in New York and 10 other states. Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League, which was the target of a bomb threat last week, has said the recent threats against Jewish community centers appear to be coming from the same person or persons. The ADL has also recorded a sharp rise in anti-Semitic attacks since Trump has been elected president. The ADL has issued a security advisory warning Jewish institutions across the country to boost security and has offered a $10,000 reward for information in the arrest and conviction of those responsible.
An Idaho judge has sentenced a 19-year-old high school football player to 3 years of probation and 300 hours of community service for assaulting a mentally disabled African-American teammate whose name has been withheld. During the assault, 19-year-old R.K. Howard admitted placing a coat hanger in the victim's rectum and then kicking it in, forcing it further, though he stated to the judge that the kicking was an accident. Howard pleaded guilty to felony injury to a child as part of a modified guilty plea known as an Alford plea, which acknowledges he would be found guilty at trial, but still maintains innocence. District Court Judge Randy Stoker said he didn't feel that the offense was racially motivated, despite the victim enduring months of bullying and taunts of, quote, chicken eater, end quote, quote, watermelon and grape soda, end quote. Judge Stoker's decision had sparked backlash across the country from people who feel Howard should have been sent to prison and those who have noted that the taunts the judge dismissed have roots in common stereotypes for African Americans. Janetta Williams, who is the president of the NAACP Tri-State Conference of Utah, Nevada, and Idaho, has called for Judge Stoker to step down from the bench after rejecting the judge's statement that the case had nothing to do with race. Williams also pointed to a case earlier this month in which Stoker suspended a 15-year sentence of a 19-year-old man convicted of the statutory rape of a 14-year-old girl, telling him only that he is not to have sex with anyone unless he weds them. An online petition calling for Stoker's removal has been circulating and has gathered 150,000 signatures.
After Donald Trump and the Army Corps of Engineers granted easement for energy transfer partners to drill under the Missouri River, the water protectors at the Standing Rock Camp have been steadily leaving. The eviction deadline for all still left there was Tuesday, and few have remained. Heidi Bogoshan from the program Law and Disorder spoke with National Lawyers Guild attorney Jeff Haas, who had been living at the North Dakota encampment.
Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's been a while since we've spoken, and a lot has happened, including the installation of a new president. And today we're actually catching you on the day when the authorities have asked the protesters to leave the camp. Can you give us a sense of what's going on there and what's been going on for the last few days? How are people feeling?
Yeah, well, I was there at the camp actually last week. And the people that are left in the main camp are the Ochetti camp, maybe 300-400 people. They started really trying to clean up the area. People have left a lot of things behind, everything from teepees and trash to cars, abandoned cars. And also because of the early warmth in North Dakota, things were 2 inches deep in mud because the snow was melting. So conditions were a little difficult, but people had sort of, those who were still there, many were banded together to try to clean it up, and they actually had some support from the tribe with some heavy machinery, and also from, I think the Oglala Sioux had offered some heavy machinery. When I was there, the Army Corps of Engineers, they've given them a notice that they have to be out by the 22nd, but they came in last week and said, we want to observe and figure out how to help you or how to clean up also. So there was sort of a standoff publicly on a bridge between the people in the camp and the Army Corps, and they agreed to let some observers in. And then since then, for the last week, I think they've been working together pretty regularly because everybody wants to clean it up because there's a possibility of a flood and everything that would be left in the camp might end up in the river. So there's been cooperation for the last week of people actually cleaning up heavy equipment, picking up their personal belongings. However, a number of people in the camp say, well, once it's cleaned up, we don't intend to move. We may go to higher ground within the camp to avoid a possible flood, but we're still going to stay here. They're facing an eviction notice that starts today at 2 o'clock. And they can be served by the Army Corps of Engineers with trespassing citations, which carry, I think, up to a $5,000 fine. The Army Corps does not have exactly a armed unit, but they have the authority to bring in local police. And so it's possible at 2 o'clock the police could come in and do a sweep or try to do a sweep. The people inside who say they're staying, they say they're not going to be violent. They're going to be praying. They have a right to be there. They feel that not only is it treaty land, but also they feel that the struggle, as long as there's a stand there, then the other efforts like the divestment movement and the support around the world will continue. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. After today, the Army Corps of Engineers has also said they will not allow anybody in after 2 o'clock who has left.
Jeff, I understand that the numbers right now are around 300 individuals there. But on the other hand, we're seeing a surge of activities across the nation in solidarity or in protest to other pipelines. Why do you think the numbers have diminished at Standing Rock?
I think a number of things have happened. Conditions got, there was a blizzard, and it's very difficult to live in a non-permanent structure when it's wind chill 30 or 40 below and a lot of snow. I think they have, some of the support that the tribes were given has been withdrawn, so some of the facilities have been taken out. It's very hard to survive in this situation. Also, the actual drilling, which has gone on a little distance away from the camp, has been protected by law enforcement, and they've been given the permit to go under the river. Some people say they've already completed that drilling, and the oil, other than testing oil going through the pipeline, it's been completed. So it's somewhat of a symbolic gesture. There's so many encampments. When you're up there, on all the hills, there are all these surveillance vehicles and armed vehicles. you feel like the camp is totally surrounded. It's sort of like in a valley with the military on all sides of them, including Turtle Hill, which is a sacred site. So I think that the conditions, and then some people have actually, there's a new camp set up just south of there, which is not on Army Corps land, which is on reservation land, that has been set up. And so people are going there. I hear there may be some veterans coming back. And there are two other camps, the Camp of the Sacred Stone and Rosebud, that also have people, but that are not on Army Corps land. Even though the Sacred Stone camp has been given an eviction notice by the tribe to leave sometime next week. So I think a combination of the conditions, the difficulty of actually protesting at the pipeline, just the weariness and the difficulty of giving up your life and being out there for so long. And then it's been taken up around the country. As you said, so many cities have had so much have actually had protests, and then the divestment movement, which is focused on Bank of America and Wells Fargo. In Seattle, the whole city divested $3 billion in funds. I know here in Santa Fe, we have a resolution to divest. So I think it's been taken up nationally and internationally. It's a difficult situation at the camp. As I said, the pipeline itself looks like an outpost from Iraq. I mean, it's got concertina wire around it. They put a missile there that has special surveillance equipment. I think all of those things contributed to the difficulty of maintaining a large presence in camp.
That was Attorney Jeff Hess speaking on the program Law and Disorder. Brazil's annual carnival is in full swing. Festivities began Friday and continue into Ash Wednesday. The festival originated in the 1700s when Portuguese immigrants took to throwing mud and food at each other. The carnival now, it features large groups from samba schools dressed in elaborate costumes for parades and balls that attract over 2 million people each day. The event is expected to generate an estimated $1 billion in revenue for the city of Rio. The parade in Rio was marred by the injury of 20 people who were pushed against a wall by a faulty float at the start of the famed Sambódromo show. But the accident did not stop all the night parade by the six of the city's elite samba schools. The carnival festivities are an escape from a two-year recession, record unemployment, a widespread political corruption scandal, and mounting crime in Rio.
Sabrina de Sousa, an ex-CIA officer who was convicted of kidnapping, has been partially pardoned by the president of Italy. De Sousa was convicted of being involved with the kidnapping of Egyptian cleric Obu Omar in 2003 as part of a CIA counterterrorism program, allegations that de Sousa routinely denies. De Sousa is one of 23 people to be convicted of having involvement in the Omar kidnapping. The partial pardon will reduce de Sousa's jail time from 4 years to 1 year, with that year being served using alternate means. The former agent claimed that she was a low-level scapegoat for the Bush administration's injustices during the War on Terror. Obu Omar, the victim in the kidnapping case, spoke in Sousa's defense for speaking out against the Bush administration's injustices.
A French police sniper accidentally shot and injured two people during a speech by French President Francis Hollande. The sniper was on a roof about 100 meters away from a tent where Hollande was inaugurating a new fast train line in the town of Villeneuve. A waiter and a train company employee were wounded, one in the leg and the other in the ankle, local media reports. The injuries were not life-threatening. The safety on the marksman's rifle was reportedly off, and the shot was fired while he was changing position.
South Korea's National Intelligence Service reported yesterday that North Korea executed five senior security officials with anti-aircraft guns because they made false reports that enraged leader Kim Jong-un. The report comes as Malaysia investigates the poisoning death of Kim's estranged elder half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, while that investigation is ongoing. South Korea says that it believes Kim Jong-un ordered the assassination. The spy agency stated that the five North Korean officials were executed because they made false reports to their department head. Since taking power in late 2011, Kim Jong-un has reportedly executed or purged a large number of high-level government officials in what rival government South Korea calls, quote, a reign of terror, end quote.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Lino and Al Kahn. The producer is Joe Lino. Special thanks to FSRN and Law and Disorder. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zelos Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2B28BH Philomath, on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday, Talk Radio, Paul Rowland talks to writer Dale Barron about 4chan, gaming, alienated young men, white nationalism, and the rise of Trump. At 9, the Project Censored show tackles the fascist tendencies in the Trump administration and the rise of extremist opinion in place of fact-based journalism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Bike Show looks at the newly minted Street Trust and the Transportation for Oregon's Future Coalition. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one really quick by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to News In Depth. Today we're going to be talking to activist and organizer Teresa Rayford, who is organizing an action tomorrow at the Portland City Council meeting, an action that is being titled Demand Justice for Qantas Hayes through Don't Shoot Portland. Do we have Teresa on the line there?
You do have me on the line. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming on very much. How are you doing today, Teresa?
Oh, I'm doing all right. It's a crazy state of work, so it's never a really good, happy day. Most of it was spent mainly at Lewis and Clark talking about mass incarceration and police brutality. So,
well, it's the work of an activist who is really done just so much in this city to bring so many of these issues to the forefront. And, you know, real quick, we could talk about tomorrow. Don't Shoot Portland is planning an action at Portland City Council. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we've been, standing in the shadows and supporting the family of Qantas Hayes since he was murdered in early February this month on the 9th. And so after, helping the family secure an attorney and things of that sort that are necessary to help them seek justice, what we're realizing is that all of these weeks into the process, that the family has still not had the opportunity to receive information from the district attorney or have a meeting with our mayor, which they were under the impression that those entities were going to be working on their behalf to help them find out answers about the death of Qantas, which is a child that was here in Portland that was murdered basically by the police. And so with no answers, no questions, and really no engagement from the people that are doing the investigation, we want to go ahead and raise the issue so that when the grand jury goes into session, that there is a voice from the community demanding justice and that we don't exonerate another officer without the opportunity to indict and take this case to court.
Had Mayor Wheeler made any sort of attempt at outreach to the family? Because it seemed as though his initial statement seemed as though he was supportive of the investigation and supportive of the family.
From what I've seen and from what I've heard, he has not maintained contact And that's why we're doing the protest. We met with the community along with the family this week, and we're going to be doing this in partnership with the AMA Coalition and Black Lives Matter Portland and hopefully other agencies. I know I spoke to some people that are connected to Surge, and we've already talked to some of the Lewis and Clark law students so that we can make sure that we have NLG support. But we're looking for community organizations that stand up for Black lives and really for social justice and human rights to make statements and to demand, again, accountability and answers, because having a replica in the state of Oregon, if that is what they're saying that caused them to murder this child, is not illegal. The fact that he was murdered in cold blood is illegal if we can criminalize the action. Because it is done by an officer doesn't mean that it is done legally. And I think that this whole system of grand